we can move into our open public input. Tammy, do you have the sign-in sheets? So I usually start by explaining the commission rules about public testimony. We invite you to come up to the front table and speak into the mic, not too close to the mic, but speak into it. We give each citizen 3 minutes. We have a timer. When you hear the beeping noise, that means your time is up. And we'd like you to conclude your remarks. If you don't conclude your remarks, I'm really good at politely interrupting and reminding you that your time is up. So we also have received a number of handouts, materials that you all wanted to distribute to the commission. Rest assured, they will be distributed. We're not going to do that as you're speaking because that would distract from our ability to listen to what you're saying. So we've got all the copies. They will be circulated after the input. Okay, so we'll start off with Dylan Meyer. Could you come forward? And also, could I ask Fritz Merkel to come forward and sit in the other chair in preparation? So would you sit in front of the mic?
I think it's about 15.
Okay, Mr. Meyer.
So I'm obviously here today from the incident in Cove 2 with the octopus. I was a hunter. I did not know that that place was so loved by all the divers. Otherwise, I would not have done it. I went in there for the octopus. I went in there to get it, and I was using it for the meat, and I also used it to draw for one of my art projects. There were no signs posted. There were no people there when I first showed up, and I also did it right next to a dock that people frequently come to fish at. I do agree with how that place should be off limits, and it should be clearly posted. So this mistake doesn't happen again. I don't think all of Puget Sound or all of Washington should be off from octopus hunting. Just the popular areas that people do go to and dive at. That's all I have.
Okay, thanks. Thanks so much. Okay. Mike Racine, would you come forward? Okay, Mr. Merkel.
Madam Chair, Commissioners, just a bit of a bio. My name is Fritz Merkel. I'm president of the Mark Boyd Dive Club. We have about 140 members, and we put probably 150 scheduled dives on per year, most of those getting 4 to 10 people. And usually about one of them at least per week is in the Seacrest, the Cove 2 area. It's a very popular dive site. I'm a bit of a history guy for you guys. The Seacrest Park has been used for decades as a dive site. And Puget Sound and Cove 2 are located, at least by one author, as one of the 50 top dive sites in the world. Okay, so that's fairly significant when you think about, you know, Australia and all the Caribbean and all the Pacific dive sites they have out there. Just before the year 2000, Seattle rolled out a water taxi program crossing Elliott Bay, downtown Seattle, to the dock at Cove 2, essentially right behind the fishing dock. After several partial year kind of spring through fall trials, they decided to roll out a full year trial. Well, there's a rule on the board that you can't dive within 300 feet of a ferry, so they closed Cove 1 and Cove 2. That was unacceptable to the dive community. Seacrest is not current dependent. It has access to support facilities and is readily accessible to local divers. It also attracts divers from out of town, out of state, and even internationally. I personally have taken a French and a Belgian diver there, and a major part of that was to go look at the GPO because they are relatively easy to find and accessible there. So the dive community began a process to reopen Cove 2 to diving again. We gave testimony to the city council, Parks and Recreational, and we ultimately met with mayor at the time, Greg Nichols, with several hundred divers attending that meeting. We reached an agreement in 2003 to reopen the Cove 2, Cove 3 area again, creating a visual and underwater boundary for above and below water. And the distance from the ferry was reduced because we weren't working with a full-size ferry. We were working with a much smaller ferry there. The city agreed to provide materials. The dive community agreed to provide the work. So we took the materials and we installed and maintained those boundaries. We've been doing that for about the last 10 years. The boundary's been installed, maintained, and periodically rebuilt. It weathers out there, salt water and stuff like that. The last complete rebuild was done this summer, and we kept time. Oh, 3 minutes is quick. Okay, I'll just finish up to say, going to see the octopus in Cove 2 is a major part of what divers go to see. And I think that any major dive site should be absolutely closed to octopus. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Craig Willemsen, could you come forward, please? Mr. Racine?
Yes, ma'am. Ms. Chairman and members of the commission, for the record, my name is Mike Racine. I'm here representing the Washington Scuba Alliance. I'm a past president of that organization, and nowadays they trot me out of the barn as their director of government affairs as needed. The alliance represents divers and dive businesses across the state, and I believe this may be the first time that we've been in front of the commission. So by way of background, just in terms of diving in Washington State, our state ranks fourth in the nation in terms of dive participation, and it's largely due to the quality of the marine life that we have in our waters. There are roughly 75,000 divers in the state. We estimate that there are 300,000 individual dives conducted each year in our waters. We have about 15 to 20 dive clubs or membership organizations, roughly 30 dive shop operations, 5 or so dive charter operators. And while it's difficult to quantify the overall economic activity associated with diving in Washington, it is certainly in the tens of millions of dollars for items directly related to diving, namely equipment, training, travel, food, lodging. And that activity is largely focused on wildlife viewing, which is a major element of the department's mission. We're here today to testify in support of the emergency closure at Seacrest. You have a handout. I won't repeat that information, and given Director Anderson's comments about a process that would take 6 months to do to provide durable and reasonable protection for that site, and to discuss, you know, a larger scope of closures, perhaps we believe that that's a reasonable process to take, particularly given the caveat that you said, Director, if another animal is taken, then we'd revisit the emergency closure action. You know, I guess I just a couple of things. This site is a premier site for watchable wildlife in the state for marine wildlife. It's interesting to note that the slide that the director put up earlier that showed Brackett's Landing, that was the very first MPA that the state created. That is an artificial reef environment in its entirety, as is Seacrest Cove 2. All of the structure that is in both of those sites is placed by man. In the case of Brackett's Landing or the Edmonds Underwater Park, it was placed deliberately. In the case of Seacrest Cove 2, it's the detritus of 150 years of maritime commerce and shoreline activity. So, just bigger picture, it's important to note that the two premier underwater wildlife viewing places are either intentional or de facto artificial reefs. Lastly, the last thing that I wanted to say, Director, thank you for your comments. I think that you're on the right track. But I did want to recognize that Dylan Myers here today. He and his family took a lot of heat over the last week for this legal taking of an octopus. Much of that heat was vitriolic in nature and inappropriate. And Dylan, just so you know, the Scuba Alliance regrets that. And we applaud you for being here. And we appreciate your input and your participation. We look forward to working with you in the future. So well done.
Thank you.
Thank you. I generally stop applause, but I feel the same way. So I would have said the same thing, too. Thank you for that. Could I call Scott Lundy to the front table? Mr. Willemsen?
Good morning. My name is Craig Willemsen. I'm the owner of Silent World Diving Systems in Bellevue. And I guess I'm the commercial representative here. My business is a retail scuba facility. We train divers and we equip people and we run tours locally and internationally. In the Northwest and actually in the Washington State, there's approximately about 30 dive facilities similar to mine that do pretty much the same thing. During the course of my business, my staff of 10 instructors, as well as most other Puget Sound area dive instructors, use the Seacrest Coves for some of our training dives, if not all of them, for training our students. On any given weekend, you can expect to see multiple groups of divers diving in each of these three coves. We choose Seacrest for its close proximity, ease of access, calm waters, and for marine life viewing, particularly the giant Pacific octopus. These octopus are one of the must-see icons for divers in the Pacific Northwest and are always a highlight for any dive that a sport diver would make. We have divers from around the state and, like Fritz said, from all over the world that come to see these animals, and we take them to Seacrest primarily to do that. I'd just like to say it'd be a tragedy to see these animals disappear from the site. I urge you to ban the harvest of the GPOs from Seacrest Cove area. Thank you.
Thank you. Jana Nichols, would you please come forward? And Mr. Lundy.
Good morning. My name is Scott Lundy, and I am a UW graduate student, local diving instructor, and the director of conservation at the Washington Scuba Alliance. Today, I'd like to tell you a story. This story is not about two young men who legally harvested a giant Pacific octopus from the state's most popular dive site, nor is it about the uncontrolled media blitz that followed. No, this story is about a dive community who recognized the lack of protection for one of our region's most iconic species and in mere days organized to unprecedented levels to be here today to present our case. Our primary goal today is simple. The population of giant Pacific octopus at Alki Seacrest Park is unique and fragile and must be protected. This petition is based upon the straightforward economic principle of supply and demand. 1 to 2 consumptive users could harvest the entire population of giant Pacific octopus, or GPOs, at Seacrest Park within a matter of days. And there have been public threats against another harvest at this site in retaliation for the events of past week. On the other hand, thousands of divers visit this site annually and non-consumptively enjoy these same handful of animals without any ecological detriment. These divers come from across the world to visit this flagship dive site and interact with the GPO. And in doing so, they support the local economy and contribute to ecotourism in the Pacific Northwest. The octopus at Seacrest Park are uniquely capable in this regard, and they deserve to be treated as a precious commodity. You've already heard today from several prominent members of the dive community who spoke in support of this issue. There are also others in the audience supporting this issue. Those of you who are here for the octopus, could you please raise your hand? Many other divers not present today have also pledged their support, including dive shop owners, the Seattle Aquarium, local business owners, the Sea Shepherds, and a host of others. I also have an even louder voice in front of me today. I have a petition that's been circulating with over 5,000 signatures that support our cause of protecting the GPO in our waters. And I'd be glad to pass this to the commission. Today we want to begin this process by requesting a ban on scuba-based GPO harvesting at Seacrest Park. We also hope to open a dialogue with the committee and the public about making this ban permanent and extending it to other similar high-profile dive sites in the area. Finally, we urge the committee to investigate the consequences of modifying GPO rules and regulations statewide, possibly by removing the GPO from the existing shellfish license and establishing a new GPO-specific license in order to better understand the prevalence and issues associated with this species as a fishery. The orca, the six-gill shark, the wolf eel, these are all iconic local species deemed worthy of protection. It's time to begin extending the same respect to the giant Pacific octopus. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Georgia Prosick, would you please come forward? Okay, Ms. Nichols?
Madam Chair and Commissioners. My name is Jana Nichols. I am a recreational scuba diver, underwater photographer, and a past scientific diver with the University of Washington. I am here to surprisingly speak to you on behalf of Cabazon this morning. Are you shocked? First off, I also need to say that although I am employed by Reef Environmental Education Foundation, I am not speaking on their behalf. I am here as an individual citizen, resident of Washington State, on my own time and my own dime. And I've traveled from Vancouver, Washington to be here today. I am pleased to see your efforts reflected in Rule Proposals number 65, which sets a Cabazon minimum size requirement, and number 69, which reduces the lingcod season in Marine Area 4B from 6 months to 6 weeks. Thank you, and I support these proposals. Now, I'd like to direct you to the handout that you don't have. The three graphs that you see here are representative of over 10,000 fish and invertebrate population surveys that were conducted by reef volunteer scuba divers in Washington State over the past 10 years. That's about 9,000 hours underwater. As you can see, lingcod are much more frequently seen than cabazon. Yet the current regulations do not reflect this. In fact, cabazon catch limits and seasons are over twice as much and twice as long as lingcod. I would request that you reduce the daily cabazon limit in Marine Area 4B and elsewhere in Puget Sound from 2 to 1 cabazon per person per day. Shorten the cabazon season to 6 weeks to match the proposed lingcod season in Marine Area 4B and elsewhere in Puget Sound. And also add a maximum size limit to cabazon to protect the larger breeders. I'd also like to remind you, as you look at the handout, you'll see the trend downward, to note that we should be rebuilding these populations of bottom fish, not keeping steady or declining. Next, I would like to direct your attention to the bottom part of this handout as I switch topics to the giant Pacific octopus. In 2012, octopus were only seen on average about 33% of the time in Washington State overall, but in Seacrest Cove 2, they were seen at a higher rate, 37% of the time. Remember, this data is based off of 10,000 surveys conducted in Washington State. With the current harvest rate of 1 octopus per diver per day, a dive site could easily be cleaned out of octopus in a matter of a day or two. The sighting frequency is only about 1.4 octopus average per site. So that could easily happen. So thank you very much for your time. I support fully in protecting the giant Pacific octopus, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can we ask for a copy of the handout?
We'll be getting the handout, yeah. Commissioner Jennings?
Jan, I do have a question for you. I looked at the comments you submitted earlier.
Yes.
And one of the points that you raised there that you didn't have the time to bring up today was actually the level of bycatch of rockfish associated with Cabazon fishery. At least out at Nia Bay, when we did our test fishery last year, I think the numbers were approaching, and it's, you know, you have to interpret the data carefully, but you know, 22 protected rockfish were landed or taken for each cabazon caught.
Correct.
And in your comments, you pointed out that that really was an unacceptable level of rockfish bycatch, and it also sort of flies in the face of the 2011 DFW Puget Sound Rockfish Conservation Plan. So I just wanted to give you a chance to comment on that if you care to.
Yeah, thank you. Exactly. The bycatch that's from the lingcod fishery was something like 30-plus rockfish that were caught per lingcod. And similarly, the cabazon, they were in the 20s bycatch of rockfish per cabazon that was retained. So absolutely, that's one of the reasons why these things need to be reduced in that particular area for sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay, I'd like to call Patty Carter up to the front table. Okay, Ms. Prosek.
Can I request that Patty go first, because it all ties together?
Okay. Ms. Carter?
Good morning. My name is Patty Carter. I'm here on behalf of the Puyallup Historical Hatchery Foundation. I don't know how many of you have been to Puyallup to see our little hatchery, but we are thrilled to have it right downtown. It's only a few blocks from the Western Washington Fair. It has been there since 1948, 1949, and it produces lots of trout that goes to the lakes in Pierce, Thurston, and King County. What happened earlier in May, you guys are very aware of, because I sent you all a letter, and was thrilled. I wish I could tell you the excitement level that has come from the community in Puyallup in not only saving the hatchery for ourselves and for the generations to come, to be used not just by the citizens, but by the students, the teachers, the handicapped, the veterans. It's a beautiful piece of property, 80 immediate acres right there for hiking, taking your dogs, feeding the fish. I've had my grandchildren there that had never been to a hatchery, and they come away, one of them, there's seven of them, one of them comes away and she wants to be a marine biologist, and she's 10. She was very excited and asked Jason lots of questions. There's lots of experiences that come from going to a hatchery that you cannot get in a classroom. Georgia will speak to that in a moment. I am one of the founders and a director of the nonprofit corporation that we put into place and signed with the Secretary of State here in July. Since then, we have been extremely busy. I will say I've had great communications with Ron Warren. Jim Scott has been on board with this as well. In August, we were able to meet with Ron Warren, Randy Aho, Jason, and a few others, all the directors at the hatchery itself. There's a duplex building there that is utilized one side for an employee. The other side has been vacant for many years. It was agreed at that time, very excited, we went into this duplex. We can use that for an educational building. We plan to model what we want to do in downtown Puyallup as Issaquah has done. And if you've been to Issaquah, it's fabulous. 16 years ago, they were in about the same little spot that we are. We have a dedicated, intelligent, crafty group of people. Two of them are city council members that are our directors. We are get-her-done kind of people. We have two directors that are fabulous grant writers on board, itching to get things done, to get things moving. We have a pile of papers ready for the IRS to get our 501c3. We are lacking one piece of paper. We are here today to ask you if there's anything you can do to help us get that one piece of paper. It's an MOU. I am sorry. It's the MOU, and we don't have that yet, and we are in desperate need of it to get things moving. We will have tens of thousands, if not millions of dollars, coming free, not paid by the state, from these great grant writers, and all of it is going back to the hatchery, 100% with our volunteers.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Ms. Prosick?
Hi, I'm Georgia Prosick. I'm also a director and a founder of the Puyallup Historical Hatchery. I am going to read a letter from our president, who's a fifth grade teacher and is teaching his class today, can't be here. And I'm speaking for all the children of Washington. The statement I'm going to read is from David Couch. The biggest push in education right now is how can my instruction reach every student? The one-size-fits-all model that so many of us grew up with in school does not work anymore. All of my instruction needs to be differentiated, which is one of the most difficult tasks of my job. One way to get through to many students who do not typically learn best in a traditional school setting is to get them out of that school setting. A great resource in Puyallup is available at the Fish Hatchery. We have heard from many educators who currently use the facility and many more excited about the possibility of using it in the future. With an educational center, improved access for wheelchairs, and a freshened up look, the hatchery is an invaluable resource. In order to really move forward with these improvements, a signed MOU with Fish and Wildlife is desperately needed. The delay to get this signed is frustrating at best and concerning at worst. This document was constructed in concert with Fish and Wildlife officials. It is a near copy of what is in Issaquah and sets up a great framework for our relationship between the historical foundation and the hatchery. Many grant opportunities are available, and without that MOU signed, we very well might be leaving thousands of dollars on the table that could be going to improve the hatchery. I urge you to help us get this MOU signed as soon as possible so we can proceed with improvements to our hatchery. As a classroom teacher, it is a resource that cannot be understated. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Okay. Dr. Anderson, do you want to respond to that real quickly and tell us what the status is?
I would just say that I'm really excited about the partnerships that have been formed around the Puyallup Hatchery, and I'm pleased to hear of the positive conversations that have occurred with fish program leadership, and I hear their need, and I'll be speaking with the leadership of the fish program to find out where we are on that MOU, and if there are some hang-ups with it, we'll be in contact with you shortly and try to work through those. But I haven't, but I'll follow up.
Yeah, I can also add that we have gotten a sense of how important this hatchery is to the community. You've communicated that very well. Thanks. Wayne Fowler, would you come forward? No. Okay. Bill Minton. And Jacqueline Winter. Hey, Mr. Minton.
I want to thank you for the opportunity to sit here for a moment. I want to speak to the lingcod season up around Nia Bay. The bigger problem with fishing around Nia Bay is generally the weather in May and June is not that conducive and not that safe for a lot of people. I operate a dive charter and bottom fishing. I think you would the whole concept would be better served by creating an annual catch limit for lings up there. That would discourage, once people hit that limit, they're going to be discouraged from pursuing that. But I think the season up there, it's difficult to get up there. You expend a lot of effort and money to get up there, and if the weather turns on you, you've pretty much ruined your trip. And that's pretty much what I have to say on that.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And Ms. Winter?
Hi, my name is Jacqueline Winter. I'm a local student at Evergreen studying ecology, and I'm also a underwater photographer for a hobby. And I just wanted to voice my concern about the GPO, and I support a new management for GPO along with research and additional protection areas for this species to help sustain the enjoyment for divers both local and abroad. And I'd also like to comment that in over 300 dives, I have never seen a cabazon in Puget Sound. I've only seen it once up in Canada and once up in the Strait of Juan de Fuca. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I just want to repeat and make it very clear that this was the stated opportunity for public input on the withdrawn Stellar Sea Lion delisting, CR 102. Has anyone come here to provide testimony on that? Okay, thank you. All right, that concludes the open public input. Thank you all. You did a marvelous job. Very informative, as we expected. Now it's time for a break, and we're right on time. Okay, so come back at 10:30.